Like many people, I'm eating a lot more seafood these days and feeling a little proud of myself for eating healthier. But what if I shouldn't feel so proud? What if the fish I've been grilling is fast becoming endangered? And what if the sushi I love to order is so high in mercury, more than a few pieces a week, actually is dangerous to my health? To answer these questions, I spoke with Tim Fitzgerald, a marine scientist who works in the Oceans Project at the Environmental Defense Fund. The EDF is a nonprofit, nonpartisan environmental advocacy group that provides scientific information about what's happening to the planet and the creatures that inhabit it. For Fitzgerald, this means touring the globe to study various species of fish and shellfish, which types are being overfished or poorly farmed, which ones are healthy to eat, and which ones pose a serious health risk. Keeping all that straight isn't easy, but Fitzgerald and the EDF have made it simpler. By creating an easy-to-read, easier-to-carry wallet card, listing the latest news about what to order and avoid the next time you visit the seafood counter at the supermarket or go to your favorite restaurant. Well, let me ask you just one or two questions about this seafood selector. On some of the worst lists are things that for years I've thought I've been a very good person by ordering and eating. You know, Chilean sea bass, red snapper, bluefin tuna, imported caviar. They're all in the worst, and they're fairly popular choices. Can you explain with one or two of those what makes them the worst in terms of the conditions that Environmental Defense has examined?
Sure. You know, in many, maybe not all, but in a lot of these cases, these fish are being loved to death, and that they're so popular and they're so widespread and the demand for them is so high that that's really driving a lot of the negative environmental issues with each one. For example, overfishing is probably the most common environmental issue that most people associate with their seafood. You mentioned caviar, Chilean sea bass, red snapper, things like that. These are all fish that have been historically fished at a rate that was higher than would allow their populations to recover.
Well, doesn't that become sort of a catch-22 of catching fish? I mean, by putting something on the best list and you're telling people this is the stuff you should go after, you're in danger of endangering it just by leading to higher demand?
In a lot of cases, especially with the wild fish on the best choices list, one of the reasons that they're on the best choices list is that they have a very responsible and cautious management regime. So, for example, wild Alaskan salmon is on the best choices list and is a very popular and abundant fishery in Alaska. Demand for wild Alaskan salmon is very high right now and will probably continue to rise in the coming years. But one of the reasons we consider wild Alaskan salmon so highly is that the management structure is such that it's almost impossible for very severe overfishing to occur. There's lots of controls that basically shut the system down if not enough fish return to their spawning streams or if there's just too much fishing pressure.
In doing some research for this, I got really depressed about some of the global things that you have to contend with after you identify the problems. Just to use an example, that if there are Europeans that are overfishing bluefin tuna in the Mediterranean, there are scientists there that recommend quota levels, and then the European Union officials double those quotas, and then fishermen routinely exceed those quotas by half, and that's just one example with one fish.
Well, unfortunately, you hit on probably one of the most extreme yet telling examples of how fisheries management can go terribly wrong. Bluefin tuna is possibly one of the most valuable fish in the world. You know, it's so prized in the sushi market, especially in Japan, that it really drives some pretty extraordinary fishing levels. Single fish have gone for over $100,000 at auction, so you can imagine what kind of financial incentive there is to catch that fish. It's also a fish that doesn't really obey national boundaries. You know, there's nothing to keep it from swimming through European waters into African waters or North American waters, et cetera. And traditionally, those are fish that are very hard to manage because they require international treaties. And when you have that kind of fishing pressure going on in multiple places for the same fish, you can imagine their populations are pretty hammered right now.
There's a new book called Bottom Feeder by Taras Gresko, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, The subtitle is How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. So I thought it was fair game. And one thing in there really creeped me out. According to Gresco, tilapia and tuna. Now, I don't know whether this is U.S. tilapia or Latin America tilapia or Asian tilapia, but somewhere tilapia and tuna are being treated with carbon monoxide, also known as tasteless smoke, to prevent the meat from turning brown and to keep it that nice, healthy-looking red almost forever. Is that widespread, and isn't that just wrong?
It's definitely very widespread in tuna. I'm not I was not aware of it being used in tilapia. But for tuna, you know, everyone wants that really deep red, almost purplish color in their tuna, you know, almost like a beefsteak. But tuna, after it's caught and once it's processed, starts to slowly turn, you know, shades of brown. And that is not necessarily an indication of bad quality. It's just the flesh starting to oxidize. But when fish are mishandled, a lot of times that will speed up the browning process, if you will, and you'll see bruises or brown spots, et cetera. And this carbon monoxide or tasteless smoke is a gas that basically reverses that process. But just from a color standpoint, it really just turns the fish back to that bright shade of red. And so it's really used to basically cover up mishandling and possibly even fish that's maybe a little bit past its prime.
And excuse this if this is a really naive question, but shouldn't there be some federal regulation that keeps that from happening?
Well, there are a lot of unfortunately, there are a lot of these consumer right to know things that there doesn't really exist good regulation for. Another example, very similar, is the orange coloring in farmed salmon. In the wild, you know, salmon are eating a whole bunch of things, and some of them are krill, which, you know, have shells that have this red or orange pigment in their shells. And so the salmon eat the krill, and they absorb the color from the krill, which is how they get their very distinct orange color. But in farm salmon, they're eating formulated pelleted feed, which is made from a combination of ground-up fish and soy protein and minerals and those kinds of things. And so they have to put a synthetic version of that pigment into the feed. Otherwise, the farm salmon would be kind of a grayish color. And so in some places, it's actually required by law that you label farm salmon as color added.
And then I have questions about one fish that I see and don't know what it is, and another fish that I don't see and wonder where it is. What is a Hawaiian butterfish?
A Hawaiian butterfish? Well, as you've probably noticed in many seafood markets, names are not always consistent. And a lot of times you can pretty much call a fish not anything you want, but there's a lot of leeway in the regulatory system for fish names. A Hawaiian butterfish can be a number of things. The most common is probably something called escalar, which is a pretty interesting looking fish. It's also sold in sushi restaurants under the name white tuna. And from what I've read, in about 50% of the people that eat it, they have a, how can I put this lightly, a negative intestinal reaction to it.
Ah. And
yeah.
And I may have this wrong, but wasn't Chilean sea bass once called something a lot less attractive than Chilean sea bass?
A Chilean sea bass is actually just a, you know, one of these made-up market names to make the fish sound more appetizing and probably sell it for more money. The more kind of common name is Patagonian toothfish.
Gee, why would you ever change that? And so the one that I don't see anymore that I used to catch when I was growing up in South Florida, kingfish, is that still out there or is that called something else?
It's definitely available. Again, it's one of these fish that goes by four or five different names. You said you were catching it in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Probably king mackerel. It's definitely still around. It's actually a very well-managed fishery. It's just it's not something that you see a lot in the commercial markets, you know, outside of where it's caught. It's a very popular recreational fish.
Would it be on your okay, worst, or best list?
It's not on our seafood card just for the reason that it's not a very large market share.
Mm-hmm.
We do have more information about it on our website. But another thing to point out with that specific fish is that it is tends to be very high in mercury. So it is actually on the FDA advisory list for mercury levels.
What are the dangers of farmed salmon? I understand that there are times where they can get caught in nets and then they get parasites and they get diseases and there are all sorts of side effects that aren't supposed to be there and aren't very beneficial to the whole fish farming system.
Unfortunately, there are a number of environmental issues with salmon farming. It's probably one of the poster species for, you know, how not to farm fish. They're grown in what we call net cages or net pens, which are just, you know, kind of floating enclosures in nearshore waters. And a lot of times they grow them at very high densities. And just like with chicken or pigs or any other animal, when you grow them in very close proximity to one another, a lot of times they'll get stressed. When they get stressed, they're more susceptible to disease or parasites. When they get diseases or parasites, they often have to be treated with chemicals or antibiotics. So unfortunately, you have this kind of negative feedback cycle where one problem begets another. And there's also issues with harassing or even killing predators. A lot of times there will be seals or sea lions that, you know, are just trying to get a free meal. They see this floating pen full of dinner and they just, you know, want to get a little bit. And a lot of times farmers will either install these acoustic harassment devices, which are pingers that drive the animals away, or sometimes they'll even just shoot them. So those are just some of the issues with salmon farming. They also create a lot of waste, which doesn't get treated. It just goes directly into the environment, given that it's a floating cage. So a lot of pretty serious environmental issues with salmon farming.
What fish would you steer us towards that we might not have ever tried before that we ought to try?
Well, a lot of the fish that are on our best choices list are some of the smaller, oilier, and some will say stinkier fish. things like sardines and anchovies and mackerel and those kinds of things. They definitely have a strong flavor, but most of them are fairly small species of fish, and smaller fish tend to be more resistant to overfishing. They grow quicker. They reproduce quicker. They're able to replenish their populations. And the other nice thing about them is that they tend to be less expensive. And a lot of people think that sustainable seafood or organic food or, you know, fair trade, et cetera, that automatically means more expensive. And in a lot of cases, many of the fish on our best choices list are similar in price or less expensive than things on our worst choices list. Canned salmon is another great example.
Let me ask you a question about eating at a sushi restaurant. With all of your knowledge, I'm wondering how you do it, especially if you order like a sushi deluxe platter or something and you're just getting whatever the chef is giving you. How do you take the knowledge that you have and make informed decisions about what you're getting, what you're eating?
Well, it pretty much rules out the possibility of the sushi deluxe platter, because at least half of that is going to be farmed salmon, farmed shrimp, longline caught tuna, et cetera. So when I eat at sushi restaurants, I normally have to go on the a la carte menu and pick out specific items. I like a lot of the shellfish, for example, octopus, squid, clams, oysters. Saba or mackerel is actually another one that I really like a lot, and it's a really good indicator of the quality of the restaurant itself, and that it's a fish that, again, is very strong flavor, and so you can tell right away if it's a little bit off or if it hasn't been handled properly. But if you find a restaurant that has good mackerel, that's definitely one to stick with.
Well, Tim Fitzgerald, thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Tim Fitzgerald, marine scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund. You can download and print one of his Seafood Selector To-Go cards by going to our website, freshair.npr.org.